You're listening to the Boiler Room Podcast.
Hi, everyone. Hello. I'm Colleen from Classic Album Sundays. Welcome to a very, very special event celebrating J Dilla's Welcome to Detroit on BBE. So the way the evening is going to work is Raj Chowdhury from Boiler Room will be interviewing Aunt Fiddler here. Can you give them all a hand? All right. So over to Raj and to Amp.
So very similar, if I don't know if people listen to the Donuts podcast, but going to try and break this talk up into two parts. One, we're going to go through the history of J Dilla and sort of the early years, which this guy was crucial and a very important part in basically what J Dilla became to all of us. I had this little thing which I just copied and pasted from Wikipedia about who Amp Fiddler is, just to give a breakdown,
okay.
Which is Joseph Amp Fiddler is an American keyboardist, sound designer, singer, songwriter, and record producer from Detroit, Michigan, USA. His music styles include funk, soul, dance, electronic music. He's probably best known for his contribution to the band Enchantment as part of George Clinton's Parliament and Funkadelic groups from 1985 to 1996. His first solo album, Waltz of a Ghetto Fly, was released in March 2004, and he's done his own, you know, solo career since. He's got a new one coming out soon. Everyone forgets a guy called Cricket. So I literally just spoke to him about 20 minutes ago.
That's right.
And Cricket went to school with Dilla, and Cricket brought Dilla to you.
Cricket brought Dilla to my house with Slum Village and four or five other kids.
So what is probably missed out in Wikipedia pages is Amp Fiddler taught Dilla how to make beats. A lot of people know that.
That is missing, isn't it? We have to put it there. As of today, I think we should put that there.
Everyone knows that, but what Cricket just told me is he was the first kid to get brought in because he lived down the road from you.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about me meeting all those kids in Coney Gardens is that, see, when I was a kid growing up learning, there were guys in my neighborhood who would school us. So by the time Cricket came to my house, I had the window open in my basement because I didn't have glass black windows then. It was just a flip window. So the sound was loud, and he was young, and he said he wanted to learn. He could rap, and he wanted to record. So I said, okay. And he said he was going to come back. He came back. He said, I'm coming back with my crew. He bought about 7 or 8 people, and I'm sorry,
equipment's expensive. I don't want one of these kids.
No, man, it was cool. I was like, okay. So when they came, they all introduced themselves, and I said, so am I making the beats for you? Am I producing this? And they said, no, James can make the beats because he makes beats. So I was like, how you making beats, James? If you came over here to make beats, what you need me for? Are you making beats, James?
And because this is what blew my mind. How was he making beats then before he met you?
James said, I make beats from my cassette player. From cassette to cassette. I was like, get out of here, man. You're not making beats from the damn cassette player.
Overlaying it, redoing it with just basic tape cassettes until he made these beats, which Cricket was saying they were pretty dope beats considering you're doing it with tape. They all went to a school called Pershing High, and pre-Slum Village, pre-Fantastic Volume 1, which is where you guys all start to know about him, they had a group called Ghost Town, which was Slum Village and two other groups which Cricket was a part of, and they were basically like, Cricket said it was 16 years old, and they were like the Wu-Tang Clan of Detroit, or at least trying to be, with RZA on a tape player. What was he like as a kid? Was he shy? Was he like, yeah, I'm the shit?
No, he was very modest, very respectful. I used to talk to my Dukes about that all the time, how I used to tell her how I was so proud of how she raised him because he was so respectful. You know, he would knock on my door and ask if he can work in the basement, but respectfully, you know, it was never any disrespect, never any loud talk, kind of shy, modest, hungry about getting the work done, though, you know, so.
So how did he take to it? How did he take to the MPC?
He took to it really good. He would come ask me for help because I just let him stay in the basement, so, and I had tons of records in the house, so he just went through stuff. But it took him time because you got to understand language. You got to learn a whole new language of the MPC. You have to learn truncation, cutting and pasting, and all those things were new to him. Truncation was new. Trimming the sample, all of that was new to him. So there was a lot of things that he learned really fast, though. So he'd come and ask me questions, and once he got it, he never asked again, and he never looked back. So he learned really fast. The first song that we made, it's called Ghost Town to the Break of Day.
Somebody's got bad breath.
Stupid mother, son of another.
Oh, you ready to record this, brother?
Hey, man, I'm not here, man.
Okay.
Okay, you're ready. You can take one.
You dig? Somebody's got to start it.
Eeny, meeny, mighty, but what style shall I pick? This track is moving fast, and yes, we do it quick. The rapper's coming out, I just like the bullets off flick. So, yes, better this time, you better get sick. I'm from the ghetto. I love it, my ring ain't a heavy metal. That's a no-no, Sedono. Ride the bubble. Under the shadow, fights the battle of life without a gun or knife. But I remember when Cricket said.
So, out of Ghost Town, Slum Village grew. And from Fantastic Volume 1, they have a unique sound, which, like, you know, still to this day, people are trying to emulate.
I think T3 and Dilla had a great concept and idea of what they wanted to sound like. And I think Dilla's development with the MPC helped him to discover that style.
Rock to the rhythm, forth and back, forth and back, forth and back, 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 back. Just rock to the rhythm, forth and back, forth and back, forth and back, 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 back.
I was on tour, so they moved from my basement over to RJ Rice. So they had access to a lot more equipment. RJ Rice had a big mixing board, a 2-inch reel-to-reel tape. So I think that gave them an opportunity to explore and really do whatever they wanted to do. And I mean, you can hear the influences in the music. You know, Tribe was a big influence on them, which is interesting how I just happened to fall on tour with Tribe Called Quest while working with Slum Village.
They were constantly plagued with comparisons of Tribe Called Quest, right, which I guess worked out in his favor because he ended up being a producer for Tribe Called Quest.
Right.
But he also has gone on record and said he didn't like the comparisons because some of their lyrics, especially Dilla, were like
quite different.
They were quite fucked out. They were quite gangster shit.
Yeah, no, yeah, this is Detroit.
It wasn't.
it was definitely not.
He wasn't. He didn't really like. But it's his music so soulful, but then his lyrics tell a different story.
Yeah, I agree.
When we Skyped last week, you said you made a promise to Dilla and T3 to put them on, to get them out of Detroit. You essentially introduced them to Tribe. Can you talk us through how that happened?
Well, after they left, Dilla said to me, I can't wait any longer. I'm about to make some moves. And I think I've got something better going on with John Sally and over at the studio with RJ. So I said, okay, best of love. But I said,
Did you feel hurt?
No, I didn't. One thing about me was I never had any paperwork or any desire to hold them up from being successful. I said, I think and I hope that it works out for you, because it would be dope if you can get on and they can really put you in the place that you need to be.
So for people who don't know, RJ Rice ended up running Barrack Records, which put out Fantastic Volume 2 after the first album fell through on the major. And, you know, there's been a lot of inner conflict, and I don't really want to talk too much about the politics and all the different stories. Yeah, it's you know, we're here to talk about the music, but a well-known story is how you toured, was it with Parliament or Funkadelic or with Tribe Called Quest?
I was on tour with George Clinton and Parliament and Funkadelic. Clinton. It was Lollapalooza.
And Tribe was supporting.
That's right.
And you introduced Q-Tip to Dylan.
Right. I said to him that same day that he told me that he was going with RJ and that crew, that I would still work towards making an introduction to the right people for him to get on. So when I got on the tour, I was on the bus quite a bit with Tribe, hanging out, listening to music. So I started playing him Dilla beats, and I left him a cassette.
Old school.
Yeah. A cassette. Not a CD.
You kids know what that is.
So I kept telling him, I was like, man, you want to check this kid out? He's dope. I said, he learned everything from me. I said, you know. I said, y'all don't know. I said, y'all don't know. I've been using that MPC since 1989. I bought my first MPC 60. I said, y'all didn't even know how I could make beats, man. But I taught this kid that's even better than me on the hip-hop shit. So I said, they were like, yeah, okay, we gonna check him out. It's like, I was like telling you, Tip, he's the shit. Yeah, I'll check him out. Okay. So I was telling Ali, I was like, Ali, you gotta check him out. Ali's like, yeah, but check out my man right here. So he played D'Angelo, because they were making D'Angelo.
Oh,
they were making
D'Angelo.
This is
like a battle. So he told me, while you were like, yeah, I've got this kid called Dilla, Tribe were like, yeah, we've got this kid called D'Angelo.
Right.
What a battle that is.
And D'Angelo was hot. I was like, man, that's hot. Man, that shit is dope. So Ali was helping D'Angelo with his demos. And I had the Slum Village cassette, and so when we got to Detroit, I went home, and I got my little whip. So I went and picked up T3 and Dilla. They didn't have a car, so I went and got them, and we drove up to the concert, and I introduced them to George Clinton.
Oh, you introduced him to George as well?
Mm-hmm.
Did George care?
George hadn't heard the cassette, so he didn't, you know. I didn't bother with George. That was my man. I already knew. So I took him. They went on the bus with Tip, and they talked. It was about maybe a year later, though, when Tip called him. I'd be like, Tip, when you going to call JD?
Yeah, man, I'm going to call him. I'm like, okay.
You should call him, man. So he finally called him. And before I know it, he was in the UMA. And before I know it, I'd be walking down 7 Mile. I see JD rolling in a brand new Range Rover. That's what's up right there. See, that's fulfillment. That's the ultimate fulfillment.
So
to help someone and see them strive and succeed.
Yeah.
That's life being fulfilled in a big way, you know. And I told Tip, I was like, Tip, man, when you gonna take care of me for hooking up Dylan?
Ah, now you gotta see Dylan about that.
Well, I said, you know what, man, it's cool, because I did that. I would have signed him if it was really about the money. So it's like, it's cool. I'm glad that he's with you, because I know you're gonna hook him up and take care of him, and it's all good.
Tip's version of events is there wasn't that period where he stalled and finally called him. He bugged out straight away, called Questlove up, ran up an $800 bill playing Questlove the beat. Uma quickly formed, Soulquarians quickly formed. Everyone wants to claim, you know, Jay Dilla when they've discovered him. But how was that period? Because, you know, I think it was from 96 onwards, immediately, suddenly his discography went from just doing a first down record with Fat Cat, local rapper, to like, okay, yeah, this guy's on De La production, he's on Far Side production, he's on Tribe production, he's on Busta production, all within a year, all 96.
I think Tip really hooked him up. I was really happy about that because Tip really put him in good places. And that's liable to make anybody feel good about the head, you know, so. Of course, you know, he got a little ego about himself, but why not? He was a kid. He was young. I probably would have, too, if I'd had that level of success that fast, that young. You know, it's taken me a succession of years to have my success. I think that, you know, his hard work paid off. He definitely worked for it, and he made a lot of music. So I wasn't mad about it. I was like, wow, that's really sweet. So even if it is going to his head, it's natural that that would happen, you know.
You know the whole Gladwellian 10,000 hours. You do anything for 10,000 hours, you master it, you become a genius at it. Right. I feel like he did that. For me, when I look at the outside in, I look at interviews, there's like conflict. Like on record, he's like bragging about cars and bitches. And people think, you know, just because of who's associated with sound-wise, that he's on this conscious thing, but he was from Detroit. And
right.
But everyone who speaks around him is all day without sleeping, forgetting to eat. He'll just be in the studio working.
I think I haven't seen too many people with that kind of work ethic that he had, because I could see in his face that he hated to have to leave my house when he was a kid. His mom was telling him to bring his ass home. She had to make him leave my house. I had to make his ass leave my house. I mean, I got work to do with that machine too, man. You gotta go. You gotta get your own shit. So I was at the crib. My boy called me from the barbershop. Said somebody brought a bag of Zips by his house, and he was going to bring them by for me because he wanted me to make beats for him and I can have them. He said it cost $100. He gave me the bag. I put them in the MPC. They were Dilla Zips. So I was like, wow, this is Dilla shit.
Straight from the barber shop.
Yep. So, so I called him. When I called him, he said, I moved last month into a new house, and the movers stole some of my shit. And my Zips were some of the shit they stole. He said, but I've been telling you I'm gonna hook you up for months.
This is Dilla talking.
Yes. And I said, you know, Dilla, you don't owe me anything, man. I said, you know how we work, and you know what my theory is about what I do. But he said, nah, you just keep those Zips and you can have them. And in my mind, I was thinking, shit, what am I going to do with your damn Zips? These are just, this is all your shit on them. I didn't make it. I got my, turning my old Zips with sounds on them. I said, okay, cool. So I just kept them. That's how karma works, when you do something good with no expectations for someone and it really flips. So that's how that karma works.
And he was cool. He was like, you can write on this, use some of these beats.
He didn't say what I could do with them. He just said, I could have them.
Okay.
It's up to me what I wanted to do with them.
Can we go through some of these files?
We can. Y'all sure y'all want to go through some of these files? Okay. So I brought the files for the MPC. And if you would give my friend Andy Mack a great applause, because he works for Akai and he hooked us up with this machine.
Yeah, shout out to Akai.
Yeah. We got a shout out to Akai anyway, because they've been carrying on tradition for a long time and keeping the music live for us. But anyway, this new unit is the Akai NBC Studio, and it controls some of the same files that I was able to transfer to digital and play in the machine, so this is one of them.
Tease him first, just give him the beat. Okay, bass.
That's that bass line.
So he, at this point, he was just actually programming all the bass lines just with the pads on the MPC. There was no instruments.
There's your bass line. So now we can see where the bass line is. You can kind of see where he might fall behind the beat a little bit or ahead. It's always seems to be sometimes either ahead or behind. But he always reminded me of reggae music because he kind of played behind the beat sometimes, which he's known for. Yeah, falling behind the beat.
You guys recognize that one?
So the other interesting thing about Dilla is that when he made this beat, he sampled these keyboard notes that he program to make the chords in this whole thing. Like, this is one of the chords. That's the other one. So, I mean, that's genius to take one note and sample it in different places and then make it into a chord and make that chord move like you're actually playing a keyboard and do it all on this thing, because it all comes out like that. That you're hearing that sounds like a keyboard player is actually from these notes. There's a kick, a snare. Here's your notes. Here's your bass line. That was basically the whole track. So I don't know what he was thinking, but I think he's from another planet.
I've had a few conversations. There's certain aliens that I believe have been brought here. He's one of them. I'd say Aphex Twin is one. Yeah. There's definitely a few aliens in our world. Yeah. We do get this money, please.
That's right. Guys might recognize this.
Well, I've already given it away, haven't I? But... It's a really tight snare, isn't it? Really tightly chopped.
Yeah. See where that snare is. It's right on the one, too. You can see where it falls, right on the beat. But his hi-hats are a little...
unquantized.
Behind.
Yeah.
See where they're behind the beat. So they're not right on the beat. They fall after the beat. Sometimes he put different kick drums on different tracks, and I can see that there's tracks that are on 5 and 6 that is kick. And then there's another kick that's on another track, so he's doing things kind of different. Thank you. see the hi-hat where it falls too. So they're just a little behind the beat, if you can see that. And not right on the beat.
Do people in the crowd know the original Herbie Hancock sample? And Jesus, what he did with it.
Keep running.
The ear is just amazing.
Yeah, it is. But it's sweet how Dylan made the bass line here.
Have the Herbie Hancock bit, the vocoder sample. Oh, he cuts it off.
Yeah.
So this is classic album Sunday. So we do gonna move on to Welcome to Detroit. But have you got one more beat for us that we want to just like maybe see the inner workings? I'll let you pick this one. I've been greedy. And this is like, how old was he when he was making these ones? He was still a teenager, wasn't he?
20.
Okay.
I think so, maybe 19 or 20, maybe.
Right.
I would think.
And this is this the stuff?
Sorry. Of course, there's some things that maybe you might not have heard before.
I haven't heard this one.
Like this one, yeah. Samples.
And he was buying records from like H2 apparently.
He had
right?
a huge, by the time he was working with Tip, he had a basement full of wall full of records.
This is when he was still in his mom's basement, right?
Right.
Chopped up that.
The sample.
Yeah. Sounds pretty chopped.
Yeah. Some of these still have to be truncated. I'm sure he didn't have that kick at the end of this one, but it's still there. Just have to check it out. With your hi-hat spotted, you know, they all, each one is different.
So, me personally, I could do this all day, but we've got to talk about
That's cool.
Welcome to Detroit, because
go for it.
It was his first debut solo album. It's, by this point, he'd broken off from Slum Village. He'd kind of done his thing with Uma, got a lot of like high-profile productions with the likes of Janet Jackson and Brownie Heavies and Busta, obviously Tribe and that stuff. But this is an album that I feel it came at a really crucial time in his career. In the sleeve notes, which was written by Dilla, the making of Welcome to Detroit, in so many words, originally went into this project to produce a breakbeat album. What happened? BB basically told me to do whatever I wanted to do. Uh-oh, get ready.
Yeah. Y'all ready for some live shit? Welcome.
Welcome to the D, baby. It's all live down here. What you see is all real. Jay Dilla, about to set it the fuck off. Beaming like Uncle B's clean my truck off. Y'all know they shouldn't have let a nigga up in this bitch. Obviously they don't know what they fucking with. Jay Dilla, bars, nigga. I'ma hit y'all with the new. Get off the ball, nigga. Hey, I'ma see if y'all ready. Count it down. 3, 2, 1.
I mean, there's a couple of like album intros that he's done that are pretty like Rough Draft especially stands out, where he's telling you what's about to happen. Now the first two tracks, the next track is called Y'all Ain't Ready. The amount of times he said "Are you ready" in the first two songs, can you have a guess?
I tell you what, he sure did change from when I knew him when he was a kid. He was different. He got all crazy as shit.
So the first two songs are just raw hip hop, and he's basically prepping. He's prepping you for what's about to happen.
Right.
And he says "ready" or the words "Are you ready? I don't think you're ready. Are you ready?" 18 times in the first two songs. So I'm going to play the second half of the second track.
That's that weed.
The point, oh, you suck. Let a 320 be a 320, you fuck. Let a real nigga do real things. Plus, I'm something serious, like Crips that bust bats. Ignorant with it, like Bloods that bust back. Cause cash, y'all really ain't ready for us. Got bitch niggas acting all petty and such. Mad cause I do my thing. If I pull out, then I'ma shoot my thing. Y'all niggas ain't ready for this. Is y'all ready?
Yeah, we ready for that.
Do you want it?
Yeah, I want it like that.
Is y'all ready?
Yeah, we ready for that.
Y'all ready?
Yeah, we ready for that.
Do you like it?
That's what you call reiterating the hook.
He was making his point, right?
That's the hook, man. They got to put the hook in your head so you remember that shit. Got to keep saying it.
Now, I'm just imagining this in my head because when you're going into a Beat Generation series and you know people lined up are Pete Rock and Marley Marl and probably people that you looked up to, and the label, all to their credit, to BBE, are like saying, do what you want. And this guy is like, hood. And he goes, are you ready? Are you ready? 18 times.
That's the hook.
And then it breaks out. I know everyone who's listened to this album knows this is a track where it switches. So he goes, are you ready right now?
That's Dilla singing too.
That's Dilla singing. It says featuring Dwele, and a lot of people assume that's Dwele on the vocals.
That's Dilla singing.
That's Dilla singing.
That's funky, man. You don't think so? I mean, it's soulful too, right there.
So he's written in the liner notes, me and my man Dwele arranged this piece. I wanted to create something that sounds like a 7-inch record, also something that feels like the 70s. You smell me. Check it out. I think we did a pretty good job. I feel like it took a label going, do what you want, to be like, okay, finally, let me like spread this out.
I think he was doing that all the time.
From day one.
That's just like, let me just do something and do something. Just have some fun. I mean, I think he worked his way up to that level of production, but I think he was always doing that style of production. Those beats were always kind of like that. It was always soulful and funky and shit, you know? So I don't think he was going that far away or outside of what he normally did.
I've never been to Detroit, but I've heard it's pretty run down, like empty warehouses and you know, like a lot of poverty from what used to be obviously the epicenter of like the automobile industry. What I find really fascinating about this album is interspersed throughout it, he tries to give you a real feel. It's obviously called Welcome to Detroit, and he tries to give you a real feel of different aspects of it. So straight from Think Twice, there's all these sort of like field recordings of real life, just right. Detroit.
Well, you know, that was why they called themselves Ghost Town.
Yeah.
Just when you went downtown, it looked like a ghost town.
Yeah.
So it was raw and very rough at the time that he made that record.
Ghost Town, just a reminder, was his group before Slum Village, the Wu-Tang version.
Right.
But yeah, he intersperses the whole album with little clips of, like, so he goes from this Donald Byrd cover, Think Twice, into people playing dice and gambling, and then gunshot straight into real fucked out rap stuff.
Yeah, it's for all my street niggas. Feel it. Bounce. Survival of the fittest. We out here to get us, y'all. What you gonna do? What you gonna do? Clap on. Clap off. Clap on. Clap off. Never take your motherfucking strap off.
Never fucking take your strap off. So, I mean, he literally went from smooth jazz covers to talking about you need a gun in Detroit.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of
is it really that bad?
Killing and murders in Detroit around that time. Like, remember, we lost Proof. We lost a lot of people to gunshots, murders, and bullshit like that, you know. I mean, I don't know nothing about that lifestyle, but...
Not at all.
I watched a lot of people die, you know. I watched my brother being robbed and shot twice in the head and lived through it, you know. So Detroit was a wild place. It was the murder capital of the United States at the time.
Oh, before Chicago.
Right. So, yeah, it was pretty rough. I'm glad it's changing. I wish the United States would change. Now the whole country is fucked up, so.
I guess a lot of people who like Dilla maybe ignore the, you know, they look at the Soulful production and Erykah Badu and Soul Quarians and stuff, but this guy was from a certain place and really represented that, especially with this album as well.
I think he represented Detroit lifestyle in that sense. I think, you know, he lived in Detroit, he came back to Detroit. It was only later that he moved to California, so he was a product of the environment. So he would naturally bring all of that into that record, knowing he had the freedom to do whatever he wanted to do and say whatever he wanted to say. So I think that was the sign of the times in that sense.
Quick side tangent. When he moved to LA, was a lot of people in Detroit going, you took that Hollywood. You took that Hollywood lifestyle.
No,
you took that sunshine and...
No, I don't think so. I think people knew that it was a natural way for him to try to move to a new level, you know?
The album is, like, predominantly rap music, and he brought in... Well, it's Welcome to Detroit. He brought in a lot of kind of, I guess, homies that he went to school
Kareem
and grew up with. Fat Cat, Frank and Dank, Beej. You knew all those guys?
Yep. All talented, all very talented, all still talented, too.
Yeah.
You know, all those guys are doing really good right now. I talk to Frank and Dank from time to time.
I'm going to be straight up and raw. All of those guys, and I love them. I've put them on in different, you know, I used to work at this record store, and Illa J and all these different people. Dilla's cast a huge shadow over their career to the point where their careers can't be mentioned without being, oh, Dilla put you on, or, oh, Dilla, like, are they just grateful for the put on, or is it, like, plaguing their career?
I think they still feel the vibrations. I think T3 is one that's moving forward and doing new things. I talk to him all the time. He's making new music.
He seems like he's constantly grasping that guy to keep the legacy alive.
The vibrations are still there. You know, you still feel that Dilla move around you. You know that it's hard to kind of miss that frequency, which is why we're all here today, because we love the sound, we love the rhythms, we love what he did,
I like this
and
shit.
What he gave us. So if he gave us that much love, then you can't really forget that, you know? It's just in them and it's in us.
But how frustrating must it be that every single article or review or whatever, someone else's name is mentioned? Like, and I'm not even talking about his direct associates. I'm talking about loads of producers nowadays can't, without being, in inverted commas, post-Dilla, because this guy left such a...
Impact. Yeah, he did.
So many people live in his shadow.
I think there'll never be another one, but I think all those people and everyone are inspired by him, and they want to let people know that it's part of their, you know, their culture, their inspiration, you know, their generation. And they feel that it's a part of them, and I guess that's big, you know. So when it's influencing you like that, it's going to make you write a different way, and you keeping that movement alive in a sense. It's always going to be changing, but some of the kids that I know who are inspired by Dilla that make beats, you can still hear their influences from Dilla yet. There's something that they have of themselves that's in that too, you know. And I've used like one of his beats on basically every record that I've made until recently, you know.
Afro Street,
all those records had Dilla beats in them, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and they're still current to this day, you know? So I understand why people are still mentioning his name, are still influenced, are still love for him, and it's all good.
With this album, I really felt he expanded as an artist, and there was a few grooves in there that showed the diversity in his music taste and collection, and I think Pete played a big part when he hung out in Detroit going,
yep,
do what you want, don't just do rap. There's like an Earth, Wind & Fire cover.
Yep.
There's a Oneness of Juju cover.
Yeah, I think when he brought Dwelle in, it was a good move, because Dwelle is a musician and a singer, so and a rapper too, so...
I'm going to just like play little snippets of these beats. So this is the Earth, Wind & Fire cover, which he like, you can hear the melody, but he made the sort of rhythm his own.
JD, beats, wanna know, STV.
Lazy snare drum played a big part in his.
Right.
The next snap, yeah.
Right.
You know, he was obviously on this album working with musician, working with Dwelle.
Kareem Riggins.
So this one.
Dynamite drummer.
In the sleeve notes, because if I do something, I've got to do it right, for real. I fell in love with Brazilian music the day I listened to a Sergio Mendes album. We used to have jam sessions in the studio after work was done. One day, my man's Kareem Riggins came, though. I asked him for Bossa Nova. He gave me exactly what I needed. Good looking. I present to you the Rico Suave Bossa Nova. But all he's doing is just going, la, 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 da, 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 da. Like, it's just like...
It's still dope.
It's still Detroit. It's still just his take.
Still dope, man.
Of all these little skits which stray away from hip-hop, Pete from BBE was saying they were playing stuff, they went through records, the oneness of Juju, right, but good. The one thing that surprised him in terms of like non-hip-hop little skit, I wouldn't call them skits because they're fully produced tracks, right, was BBE, which obviously he named after the record label, which was Big Booty Express. So on the liner notes, he's wrote, "This is my baby. This is one of those joints I've heard in my head from time to time." Crazy, right? But could never duplicate until now. Done with hi-hat from a 909, an oscillator, a metronome click for kick drum, and a magnificent Triton keyboard. And there you have it. Reminds me of some old Terminator shit. Yeah. When he submitted it to Pete,
right,
apparently he just said, "I've got a surprise for you," because Pete hadn't heard all the songs. And I think the whole point of the Beat Generation series was they gave the producer free reign, yeah, to like do their thing and do it, and he obviously named the track after the label but then did this sleazy electronic track. Now obviously with the Detroit hip hop and all those people we mentioned, Fat Cat, Frank and Dank, Beej, Slum, they were all like under the wing of Dilla. Detroit has a strong musical history from Motown, and you can hear the soul in the beats and your stuff. And but a whole nother section was Carl Craig and Underground Resistance and Juan Atkins and right, Robert Hood. And depending on who you talk to, if you say Detroit, you say, "Oh, soul and hip-hop." Other people are like, "Techno." So
that's right.
How much do those worlds overlap?
I think everybody in Detroit listens to a lot of different music, anywhere from, you know, jazz to soul to hip-hop to blues, rock and roll. So everybody's really influenced by each other in that sense. Everybody that's making techno is influenced by cats that are in the soul and hip-hop. And then all the cats that are in the hip-hop are influenced by all the guys that are making techno, because it's all got the same kind of a grit and feeling, you know? It's all, even the jazz musicians that write, like a Donald Byrd or some of the other musicians from Detroit, still have that feeling of raw grit that makes you relate. So, and I think that's what makes all the artists relate to one another and make it such a universal party amongst that shit, you know? So Dilla was definitely influenced by everything. You could hear it in his music. So that album and this album was definitely the freedom for him to probably do some things that he wasn't able to do for a while that he always wanted to do,
yep,
which is great to hear about this. That's what's so beautiful about that record.
I tried to find the overlap, and the only thing I could find is that Dilla, the year before, did a remix for In His Own Orchestra, which is an alias of Carl Craig. You know, your Carl Craigs and Underground Resistance and all these people going, "Yeah, I like that kid Dilla." And it's Dilla going, "Yeah, I like that. I like that, those techno guys."
I think so. Yeah. I think everybody was seeing that about each other, because I'm kind of like...
Was there rivalries? Like,
never in Detroit. It's all love. You would think it might be, but most of the time it's all love with everybody. Everybody really has respect and love for each other and would love to collaborate with the other.
So you worked with Kevin Sanderson, right?
Carl Craig, Kevin Sanderson.
So you're like, I feel like
Omar,
you...
Omar S, Moody Man. I mean...
All the hits.
I love a lot of music, so...
Well, I feel like you're different because you... No disrespect, but you're of a different age where you saw the transition.
I am from a...
I don't...
Let me take off my glasses so I can't see you.
You're going to get Detroit.
With my old ass. Now I can't see you, so it's good. You can talk shit all you want to. Everybody was just playing fucking music in my neighborhood, you know? So my ears were listening to a lot of different things, including hip-hop, including techno, including jazz, soul, funk, rock and roll. You know, we had DJs on the radio like the Electrifying Mojo.
Yeah.
That was just crazy, you know.
Literally every single artist we have talked about from Detroit listened to that radio show.
Exactly.
Electrifying Mojo was, what is it, like 1 to 5 a.m.?
Yes, on, right.
And he ran this radio station that played from funk to soul to hip-hop to techno to house. And all the people we've mentioned from Detroit.
The Midnight Funk Association.
Would stay up late to listen to this guy.
That's right.
That guy was probably a massive influence that, like, is probably not talked about in the wider circle.
Sometimes, but I think people are talking about it more now. And I think that's what brought a lot of people together too, the radio, you know. The radio has changed a lot.
What I love about, well, just Dilla's career trajectory as a whole, people still trying to copy 97 Dilla. By the time these guys were like just learning, oh yeah, do that late snare, this guy's already moved on like to electronic stuff, to jazz stuff.
Right.
He never looked back. He always changed his style.
Always. Always. Always on the cutting edge, always innovative, always moving forward, trying new shit.
The mad thing is, if he was alive today, I honestly could have would have no idea what he'd be making.
You took the thoughts right out of my mind. I was thinking the same thing. So I'm not as old as you think I am.
Fly gun, hold a money folder, Motorola, Star Tack, when it's time to call back. With a rough, rugged, and raw way, this nigga Jay, it's a game, but he don't play. Hey. For all the chicks that got dead in the penthouse suite on top of my mom's crib. And it's nonsense you never get in. It's nonsense that you would think that you would ever get in. K. For the cutie crushing that we do, we keep them two. We got two for you. And I knew what you would do with again. Nasty, ain't it? Brand new shit with the blend. D. To all my Detroit play ballers. And I can't forget the fat booty baller holics. Hey. For awesome amounts of dough, 1 ounce of grass. Woo. And a fat ass for show.
One thing I really feel gets missed out with Dilla is, yeah, the guy made beats. The guy could rap.
That's right.
Like, the guy could rap proper. And yeah, I just played that one because I just like that verse, but give it up.
All my live bitches, what the fuck up? My live niggas, tear the whole fucking club up. Cause when we up in the cut, you got to
give it up.
Nigga, what we got for the Benjamin?
Give it up.
Give it up, we wanna live it up.
Give it up.
Give it up for the most slept on since Pepto-Biz. When time wanna let go, Prince. Riding by, better get your bitch. She definitely ready to spread those hips. Ooh, shit stinks. You see me in the leg, so sick with the beat. Do talk shit and quick with the heat too. John Wayne couldn't even stand the rain of the tech. And the tech be like Jay in the deck. It's lethal, killing it for my people. Still up in the whip illegal.
The guy talked about bitches, he talked about money, he talked about all that stuff. Was he like that? Was he?
No, they gave him a pass because he was an Aquarius.
Yeah, well, yeah. So Aquarians, for those who don't know, is a super collective of producers, singers, DJs, which include Questlove, Erykah Badu, Common, Talib Kweli, Mos Def, James Poyser, Pino, bunch of people, and a bunch of them were literally of the star sign Aquarius, of which Dilla was. And a lot of those people, they cite Dilla and his drum programming and the way he looked at music as an incredible influence to all of them. When you have a collective of that from Philadelphia and New York and Detroit and all these different parts of America saying, this guy is an influence on our stuff, you know that's some serious stuff, because that's at the time in hip-hop soul, those were some of the most crucial and vital people around.
Yeah, I think so. I think he was at the forefront of that whole neo soul, what they called that, was him.
Absolutely.
I think he really molded that into
Absolutely.
Making it feel like it felt. You know, for me, I never liked that term because I've always been soul living. It's lifestyle. So the people that got into it to make it a name like that. It was kind of weird for me, but I always felt like he had always been that, yeah. And he influenced the whole community in Philadelphia and those Soul Aquarians with the way that he programmed.
You know about Chocolate City, don't you?
Chocolate City is a stripper bar. It's around the corner from my house.
So when they were shooting for the cover of this album, Dilla was like, I know what we'll do. We'll go Chocolate City. And they went to the strip club, which he frequented a lot. And I think that's something actually that him and Madlib bonded over, their love of stripper clubs. It's like, Madlib makes like backpack rap, but like they like going they like going to strip clubs. And they went, and Dilla said to Pete, who's your favorite girl? That one. So this girl right here on the front cover of Welcome to Detroit, they just paid her
couple hundred.
Less. Like $100 right. To like, we'll take your photo, we're gonna use it on the front cover. My name's JD, or he moved his name
she
to JD.
She already knew his name.
She had no idea who the fuck he was. It's like $100, yeah, cool. So right. Took a photo, did it. She signed on the back of like a handkerchief or something, going, yeah, you can use my image. And that's the front cover. And in it, he's smoking a blunt. He's got his big silver banjo. And that was J Dilla. And like, for me, I find it hard sometimes to know whether he got that side out of him just on record.
That was definitely a side of him before he got sick.
Before he got sick?
Yeah, he was wild then.
Really?
Yeah.
I heard he had a short temper.
He was wilding out. He changed. He was so modest when I first met him, but later.
Really?
He was that shy kid.
What changed it? The money? The rappers? The strippers?
All of that shit. You know, lifestyle changes.
Yeah.
You know, when you as you get older, you grow, you hang around, you have a new crew of cats you're hanging with. Faces and places.
Now, we can't talk about Dilla's life without talking about Dilla's death. So obviously, in his later years, you know, we lost, in my eyes, a genius too early. You said that you visited him in hospital and stuff. Did that change him? Did that humble him?
Yeah, I think it did humble him a bit. I think it changed him. I mean, I think we realize how important life is when we see death. And, you know, we all have our expiration date. But it's a whole different viewpoint when you see that, you know, your whole structure is changing and you have to fight to survive. So that changes your outlook and life changes. And I'm seeing it a lot myself with my family lately, so I really know how it changes you and it brings you closer to the spirit. So naturally, when you get closer to your spiritual self, you change and become more conscious about things that you do and you say and how you deal with people. And I think that's what happened with him. Because when I saw him in Detroit, he had changed a bit. But when I saw him in California, he was closer to his spiritual self, like when I met him when he was a kid. And that's when he said, if you need anything, let me know, and I'll give it to you. So I said, I wanted to get some more music from you, and he gave me a CD, which is a PayJ CD he had. He gave me that.
To get paid. With the Libby.
Yeah. So he was with my Dukes, and that was the last time that we really hung out before he passed. But he was definitely in his spiritual self at that time. It was beautiful to see him back into his childlike self, more mature and more spiritual.
Yeah. I'm going to end with the final track on the album, which is called One. He shouts out just a bunch of people, I guess, who he met and worked with and, like, I guess he thanks them along the way.
Oh, and you say one love to SV, Flip Mode, Frank and Dank. The Abstract, YG, Rockefeller, High Tech, Chocolate City, Badu,
You notice he shouts out Chocolate City, right?
Keeping on in, Kenny Dope, Tariq, and my man's Kweli, Diamond D, Red Man, DJ Scratch, D12, Pete Rock, keeping on in, Chris Lighty, Boo Boo, Dave Chappelle, Bilal, DJ Spinner, and Dwele, De La, Studio A, Luke Pat, Soul Aquarians, NSYNC, baby, it's like that.
You notice he shouts at NSYNC, right? Now, I don't know if you guys know, but they were talking about working with each other. It never quite happened to... You guys all laugh, but imagine Justin Timberlake on a Dilla beat, and don't act like you wouldn't be excited about that shit. Come on now, guys.
Mick Nasty, Jazzy Jeff, Janet Jackson, Wall Street, Bobo Lamb, Hop, Killian, Philly Frank, House Shoes, Whitney Goldstein, and Philip.
Now, when I next saw Dilla, I'd be like, oh, you thanking me when the music's fading out? I would give that kid a back slap.
I ain't mad about it. Because you always save the best for last.
I couldn't think of a better way.
I love that kid. You know I loved him so. Yeah. And I still love him, man.
Thank you so much. This has been really enlightening.
Thank you.